Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. I am your host, Toby. AlphaList is a closed community with over 300 CTOs that share their knowledge and experience in a Slack space and at events. With this podcast, we want to give our members and interested parties insight into the thoughts and ideas of top CTOs. If you're interested in becoming a member of the community, visit alphalist.com to find out more on how to apply. And this podcast episode is kindly presented by MongoDB, the successor of the NoSQL movement. It's a very attractive, flexible, and simple database system that can be integrated in no time. They have a developer-first approach and build a system that is fun to use and scale to terabytes or petabytes. You don't have to think too much about your database structure. Just start playing with it and develop it on the go. I tried their new cloud product called MongoDB Atlas, and all listeners of this podcast can easily do the same and test it in their favorite cloud, GCP, AWS, or Azure. Custom tailored deployment without over-provisioning, sandbox for developers, organized in microservices, and clear focus on developer fun and quality. To keep it simple, DevOps with more dev and less ops. Just go to cloud.mongodb.com and use the promo code podcast2020 to get started using their database as a service in the cloud. Welcome to the AlphaList podcast. Today with me is Matthias Lauck. I know Matthias for quite a while, and he's the founder of a large company, large startup called Tier Mobility. And they are the leading scooter startup in Germany and collected around, I think, 130 million in funding in a very short time period. And before that, he founded Lieferando and acted as a CTO. So welcome, Matthias. Good to have you finally in the podcast.
Thanks. We took some time, so thanks for the patience.
Yeah, I'm a very patient guy. So maybe a good first question, how did you get there? What is your nerd path? So how did you get into computing, into engineering?
This is a super boring story because I'm repeating what a lot of people actually saying during an interview. It's like, oh, I got in touch very early with computers. But ultimately, this is the right story. My father was one early adopters when it comes to any kind of technology. First with the internet on the street, we needed to convince him a little bit more on DSL because I think he already foresee what's happening with the internet. So we had ESDN for quite some time, but other than that, got in touch with computers pretty early. And while in the beginning, all the knowledge that has been accumulated was mostly used to actually get the games running. Ultimately, it transitioned towards the interest in actually building stuff with it. And started at school, choose a course there. That was not the best experience. I think a couple of people at my age also remember that when they started in the schools, that was pretty boring and uneducated stuff. But then, went into an apprenticeship because I wanted to be hands-on. And then ultimately figured, okay, a little bit of background in the theory might be interesting. So I went to Berlin for studies.
You actually, during your studies, met the other founders of Lieferando and started there as a student, as far as I've heard, and took break from your studies and said you just finalized the code of Lieferando and then continue your studies. Is that right? Did that work out?
That is absolutely correct. While I mentioned, like, from my apprentice, I went to university because I wanted to know some of the theory. At the second semester, I figured, okay, some hands-on experience is still quite valuable. And I got in contact with them. They required someone to get things off the pilot phase. And I considered, okay, I can get this done in 3 months. So it wasn't necessarily a break from studies, but actually during my summer break.
Okay, and some more sporty insights into your life is that you actually wear a black belt in judo, is that right?
A brown belt, yes.
A brown belt, and you are like a master in backflips.
Yeah, this is the old stories from the old times at Lieferando. When you're young and you're still in full control of your body and Yeah, I would say like have a couple shots too much and believe you're superhuman, and you make a backflip of the bar. It was fun at that time. I don't think I can pull this off anymore.
That's then the Christmas party stuff, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Nice. And right now, do you still every once in a while code or?
It's still something that intrigues me a lot. I love coding. I love changing things. It's the one thing where the feedback cycle is the shortest in how you can actually have impact on the business. So once in a while, I like to not get too rusty on it. But I'm also quite privileged and honored having such amazing people in the company that it is a choice and not a must.
And after your time at Lieferando, I think you are lucky and got like a bit of a bonus in the exit. You worked in consultancy, is that right? And why did you do that?
First of all, I like this German hesitation of talking about money. But yeah, obviously, the IPO, there was also something in for me. So I went to ThoughtWorks for the culture. So it was not necessarily something to do about going into consultancy, while I knew the benefits that I can jump between different topics without actually changing employee. But ThoughtWorks always intrigued me as a company. There's so many people such as Martin Fowler, Pat Kuhr, like strong influencers in the entire tech sector. So a lot of the books that have been written about DevOps are alumni from ThoughtWorks. And I just wanted to experience this firsthand, and I've never regret this decision because it allowed me to reflect on a lot of things that I've done at Lieferando. It gave me the time for it. It also gave a lot of critical input. Your ThoughtWorks has been known for being quite opinionated, and they voiced this. And if you're able to digest this kind of criticism and inputs from others, then I can only recommend this for to everyone in tech.
What was the biggest thing you learned?
So it's people over tech, ultimately. It's all about people. It's about diversity, and it's about making changes in society that actually drives people, that drives people to come to work. And that makes also a lot of people reflect now on their work when they're sitting at home and actually wondering, what am I doing here right now?
And after that, you started a scooter company to also change the world a bit, or?
We're getting there. We're getting there, I would say. It started a little bit, and that's definitely one of the downsides from ThoughtWorks. The clients are quite corporate because there is where the money is, and they are able to pay this kind of high-priced consultancy. Yet the last project that I was on was one of the big car manufacturers to revamp the entire sales platform. And it was in the midst of the diesel scandal, and I didn't really like that, but I wanted to stay in mobility. And I also figured I'm building here a sales tool for a company to sell even more cars. I don't even own a car. Why is that? Do I need one eventually? And I'm still trying to get through this path with having a daughter here at home now to still say, okay, how can you set this up for yourself that you don't need a car? And this is ultimately also the ambition that I have with Tier, that we provide people with a convenient alternative, that ultimately the goal that also Berlin has to become a car-free city. And I know we're far off that. It's one of the solutions that we provide. Additional solutions need to be provided. Also, convenience needs to be addressed. And nobody's going to use frequently a scooter if it's going to rain and it's cold. There's also need to be solutions for that. And I think we want to find this solution together with the cities, and that is what we're aiming for.
Okay, but with a child, it's still a bit challenging to use one of your scooters, right?
It can be also quite fun. Not necessarily using with a scooter, but there's also ultimately we want to provide bike solutions. Putting a kid on there might be something that can be part of the hardware that we're providing. The cars in the street, once electric, are not necessarily out of our scope, but I wonder, does it need to be the ones that are off the shelf? Are they equipped to be actually ready for sharing? It's still five-seaters, and there's, based on the numbers that we know, like 1 to 2 people in a sharing car. So why does it need to require five seats constantly? There might be use cases for that, but the majority of them serves a single person. So can it be a way smaller car? And how about the electricity? Where do they get their recharging from? And this is the aspect that we're particularly thinking about holistically to change the city and change mobility for good.
Okay, that sounds like a very nice pitch. That's also your vision for TIER, I guess.
Indeed. I had to drop it ultimately.
Very nice. And yeah, if you look at what I'm interested in, like the software stuff and the hardware stuff, what is your secret sauce if you look at your product from a techie perspective?
Yeah, This is the intriguing part. Even coming from a CTO perspective, I'm really trying to put people over the tech stack there. So what we started with in the beginning, that was an experiment and it worked actually out as I expected it. I gave people full liberty on what they're going to choose for. So do you want to use Python? Do you want to use Node.js? Do you want Java, Kotlin? I don't care. What was the result? Ultimately, they agreed on two languages and this is now the main stack. It's Python and Node.js with the flavor of TypeScript. They hadn't had to be constrained. They took the liberties and they understood, we need to get alignment on those topics. Otherwise we won't be scaling. Every time a new team starts and they go for another language, they need to reproduce all those facilities around them, from logging infrastructure, from connecting to, from deploying pipelines, scaffolding, all that had to be redone. And then people are ultimately lazy. And they said, I'm just going to use what is present. And that is in the majority now, Python and Node.js.
Okay, and if you drill a little deeper, so what are the secret ingredients? What is the special thing about your product? I mean, where's maybe the biggest brain flowing into the biggest amounts of brains?
I'm going to be modest on that topic. I don't think we have a special sauce when it comes in how we building things. It's Kubernetes ultimately based on AWS. We're using Postgres as a majority of the backend. Some people experimenting now with MongoDB or like DynamoDB from AWS. We started with the Lambda stack. It was pretty convenient. We scaled out of that into Kubernetes. So it's not necessarily the stack that is special. I think it's the ability to act to changes and being continuously fluent on this. And this ultimately boils down to people and making them understand what you're actually thriving for and less of what the choices you're going to do in tech. We're not in rocket science. So to maybe answer your question to a certain extent is, I think the interconnectivity between hardware and software is the part that we put the most brains in. And there's ultimately going to be a differentiator. So I strongly believe, and we're not there yet, that while currently we are deploying centrally into a Kubernetes cluster, this kind of business logic is going to be deployed on the scooter or on the vehicle of choice. So we want to transition more towards an IoT platform, where the IoT platform becomes a computing unit of a huge cluster. And what scales better than a vehicle that ultimately serves one person at a time? So 0 von 1, you don't need to think much about scale in this moment because every single device that has been provided to a customer will have sufficient computing power to serve this very customer. And then the next customer, and then the next customer.
Okay, interesting. Besides me, like being interested in the data that is generated, we talk later about that. What does it ultimately mean, or where do you stand there now? I mean, I guess every device has like a 4G card and like a small CPU, potentially another CPU in the battery. There's like a firmware running on it, and I guess you don't have that much impact on the design of the chips and that much impact on the software that is running on it, right?
So the majority of hardware is currently still not necessarily off the shelf. It's customized through input by a supplier. And that has been our strategy until this point. we see the weaknesses of those strategy right now, and that is that it becomes harder and harder to iterate over this hardware. But instead of like doing a big shift now towards, okay, we're going to build it ourselves, that would be ludicrous. We're carving out parts by parts that we want to own. Like the IoT is one of the first topics that we want to own. We want to own the battery ultimately. Running the battery network requires this from us, that we have full IP over this, and we do have it, but we also ultimately want to manufacture it.
Okay. And the software that is running on the device, is that controlled by yourself right now?
Not at that point, no.
But that would be possible, I guess, right? Even if it's
produced in China. It is possible. Exactly. And we're iterating there with the supplier as well. At the point where we're going to put our own IoT on this, with the idea of this platform, we're going to a majority of the stack, if not all.
Okay. And long term, you think you don't need a central server, or not necessarily a central server, but the devices are talking to each other, or...?
It's actually the same idea that I have with Lieferando. I'm always trying to figure out what is the smallest fraction of computing needed. And it's ultimately always the customer if you're in a customer-oriented business. So what I did with Lieferando was that we generated all the pages that people are going through statically, provided them via a CDN, and just... generated the changes in the back and uploaded them back to the CDN. That ultimately meant that all the computing power that we required was in the moment that somebody actually placed an order. Everything else was happening in the browser. And this kind of paradigma like follows me through, that I'm always trying to find this, what is the smallest fraction of scale that you can provide? And I see this in the IoT. And a Raspberry Pi has enough computing power for multiple users already. So why can't they serve a single user as well?
Yeah. So I guess there would be space for a Raspberry Pi in your device if there's space for a helmet, right?
Clearly. But ultimately, you need to make it more... so you don't do the... you experiment with the Raspberry Pis off the shelf and build prototypes around it. But ultimately, you need to customize it. There's only a certain... framing that you can put the IoT in, and you need to adhere to that. Therefore, you need to customize it ultimately.
And like coming to data a bit more, mm-hmm. So I guess like one of your scooters already generates quite a lot of data, right? What are the data points that you're collecting right now?
From the classical ones on GPS, acceleration, whether a battery has been swapped, whether a lid has been opened, so the interactions with the vehicle. And ultimately, I need to stop using the word ultimately, I hate it. At some point, we want to add also further sensoric data into it. We strongly believe that the micromobility sector can be synergically combined with creating a digital twin of the city. And for this, we require additional sensoric data there. And then provide this to the city and say, hey, we know a lot of stuff about your city because there's 5,000 vehicles constantly moving through your city. And even if they're stationary in seasonal times, we can collect very valuable information about congestion, air pollution, etc. And this gives a little bit of the insight also how holistically we're trying to think of the entire business.
I think a small camera would be very helpful, right?
Indeed. So we've actually have a prototype of this already. For all the listeners, it's GDPR compliant and very. So people are being cut out on the edge. And based on this, we could do a lot of things. Right. From simple use cases such as count how many stop signs are there in the city. Some cities don't even know that. Count how many people are walking by a certain area. Since we would have the raw material, we could also retrospectively answer any question if the city comes to us and say, OK, do you know the flow of the street? And like, yeah, sure, we can simplify it saying. We could write an algorithm on top of this and look into our historic data and find this out for you.
This episode is kindly supported by Fastly, the biggest challenger in the CDN market. Fastly is pushing ahead the technical boundaries and is, from my perspective, the best solution on the market. Fastly is known as one of the key drivers of the edge cloud movement. In one of the next podcasts, I will talk to Tyler McMullen, Fastly CTO, about WebAssembly and the edge. Well-known customers of Fastly are Shopify, The New York Times, Reddit, GitHub, and many, many more. If you want to try it all with first-class support, just go to fastly.com/alphalist. I like it. It's a very similar pitch to Arti Heinlas with Starship Deliveries. I don't know if you know him. Yeah. So they also have a lot of data that no one else has from the sidewalks, right? And I guess, like, I see a lot of your scooters on the sidewalks. I don't know if it's meant to be like that, but okay. And like, interesting for me would be how do you monitor your scooters? I guess there are, like, every once in a while there's someone stealing one of those. How's that?
So this is it's less severe as assumed. So we're not losing that many scooters. The reason is pretty simple. That thing is 28 kilos heavy now, right? That's not fun to steal anymore. If you compare it to the ES4s from Ninebot at the beginning, it was retail hardware. You could lift it with a single hand. That was a whole different game. Those disappeared. You just throw them over the shoulder and you moved off. With those, it's rather hard. And since it's not directly off the shelf, it's also harder to retrofit and hack the firmware. So this comes as an additional benefit to it. So this is not necessarily a problem. So what do we monitor? We monitor on a macro and a micro level. So we look, for example, is a scooter moving even though there's no rental? Then we have alerts for that. We also check on a macro level, do we have dip in connectivity? What happens a lot of times is a city manager calls to say, I have a scooter here that doesn't connect anymore. Do we have an issue? It's like, no. On a macro level, we don't. But this particular scooter might have an issue. And we need to always be able to differentiate that. This is paramount in such an asset-heavy business that you can distinguish between it's an individual isolated problem or it's a problem at scale, and you need to be able to look this and see this at a glance. And those are two examples that we are actively monitoring.
And what are you using for monitoring? Is that just time series data that you collect and use Prometheus or something to dashboard it? Or
this is all Amir's magic, my director of technology. And I think yes, I believe we're using Prometheus. We're also using Jaeger for transactional things, but here comes now the privilege of having a great team. I don't necessarily need to know this anymore. I know that we need to monitor it, and I'm happy that people make good decisions there.
Is there some mighty dashboard in your HQ or which you can just call from home that comes with a map of everything? How much mapping intelligence is in there?
What do you mean by mapping intelligence particularly?
Clustering areas, looking how dense areas are, looking at demand versus supply and so on.
So we have a team that is based on Hexagon clustering of the city. They are flexible on the size of this hexagon. And they are calculating their supply and demand. One of their goals, and they're teaming up with another team there right now, is to create this equilibrium inside of the city that demand always matches supply. And this is a tough nut to crack because you're always making assumptions. There we're quite good already. So the accuracy is between 90 to 95% in how we predict, including weather, the next day. What is harder to predict and which we're currently experimenting on is how much of the behavior of the customer can we actually change to park at a different location? Because just knowing where they should park is useless if we cannot influence the customer's behavior, because then we need to drive it through ops. And that is ultimately way more expensive than letting the customer go another 200 meters because we believe the scooter is going to be picked up more likely by another customer there.
Okay, how many people are working in ops in a city like Hamburg, for example?
So there's a core team, such as a city manager and an operation manager. Depending on the size, there's also then further hierarchy, such as a regional manager and a general manager for an entire country or even region, like south of Europe. And then there is a flexible amount of people that that do the swapping. We have, again, they're a core team, but obviously due to seasonality, we're obviously working there with external agencies to scale out and scale in. And our core team that we hired ourselves is working on the core things. That's rebalancing, swapping, based on what is required. And this can that scales up and down with the amount of scooters and rides we have inside of a city.
And also scales a lot with the behavior of the people you're able to change, right?
Indeed, indeed. And this is also the reason why we introduced the energy network from both sides. Like, a lot of things we can drive very efficiently with ops, but whatever we can let the customer at their benefit do is something that we want to incentivize. Like in Tampere, the pilot that we do with the energy network, 40 to 50% of the people are actually doing the swap now for us during a ride. And that is not gig working model. And that is important to differentiate. They're just getting subsidies on the next ride. So they're even becoming more loyal. At the same time, we require less operation power on swapping the batteries.
Okay, that's then the next version of your hardware, I guess, with the external battery and so on. I don't know, correct. Which cities you already have it everywhere or?
So the scooters with the outside battery are in the majority of cities, 80% by now. By the beginning of next year, we're also scaling out the energy network into the bigger cities and trying to reproduce the success that we had in Tampere.
Okay, interesting. And does that mean that there are like certain energy stations or energy stations everywhere and you don't need operations anymore or?
So we will always need operations because we don't believe that 100% of the required rebalances and swaps, and specifically the maintenance, can be done and should be done by users. But the maintenance will never be done by customers, because if you don't have the skill to maintain such a vehicle, you shouldn't do it, period. But the scooter can be designed in a way that swapping a battery is actually quite easy and is error prone. Is like less error prone and like pokey-okey. You just know how to put in the battery. You can't flip it around. It's obvious how to put the battery in. And if you design the hardware like this, simple tasks such as swapping can very well be put to the customer.
Okay, and besides the external battery, you also have a helmet box, which is, as far as I'm informed, still empty. Is that right?
That is correct. So we have in three cities, we're running the pilot right now. Other cities are prepared, but we want to get a confidence level on the usage of the helmets before we're rolling it out at scale. That has various, like the previous mentioned pokey-okey, it's not so pokey-okey with the helmet box. You can put it differently, but it has an impact whether we detect the helmet. And this is something that we want to properly iterate over before we're providing a shitty experience to the customer.
Is that something that you engineered yourself, like the helmet box and and so on? Or is that also available to others?
That is one of the first pieces of hardware that we engineered ourselves. We didn't build it then ourselves, but we engineered it and designed it and provided it then to a supplier to build for us at scale.
Yeah, from my perspective, really a game changer. I mean, if you compare yourself to the others, then like I think one big plus that Lime might still have is the integration in Google Maps, right? Is that something that's going to change or?
It definitely gives exposure and people that are switching between cities, definitely. Ultimately, it's about availability. So Google Maps doesn't help you with anything if you cannot reserve the scooter via Google Maps. And if you see that the scooter is in 1 kilometer distance, the integration in Google Maps doesn't give you much. So exposure is great, but ultimately Google is also invested there. So it's, a simple decision for them to also integrate it. But it's nothing that we see as a major drawback for us to scale as a business.
Okay, another question for the techies. Is there any hidden cheat codes in your scooters that you might tell me afterwards? Like for faster driving, the ludicrous mode, for example?
So indeed, we would have the ability to change that. But obviously, we are adhering to the rules within Germany. So there's only a limited amount of people with access that could even do these changes, and it's very well audited. So no, nobody will be able to change this to higher than 20 km/h as it is a rule in Germany or other countries.
Besides you and me in half an hour, right? So
obviously.
Coming from the software topics to the more softer topics, so you mentioned already like a few principles you have in terms of leadership and building up your company culture and engineering culture. How do you do product design? I every once in a while look into the area of product discovery and find it kind of teasing and nice. Is that also something you do with your hardware and something you do with your software product?
Yes, we do. I think that we have also to still take the longest learning curve. Victoria, my director of user experience, has done an amazing job. They're building up a user research team, a product research team, a design guild, alignment there with also the brand design. So this is something that you hear the screams. Sorry for that. That's having a child at home and working from home situation. This is all live, people. So this is something that's particularly she drives. So what they've done now is in collaboration with the marketing to have like this guideline on how the app should ultimately look like to be completely cohesive and fully aligned throughout the company. So this is something that we're particularly doing there when it comes to the design. Other than that, strong believer in doing discovery before even building anything. So we continuously reminding teams that they need to prepare what they want to invest in next. And whenever the answer is, but I'm so busy delivering, then deliver less. Because you're going to deliver easier and more when you actually prepare the things up front, and specifically the triage on the product manager, the tech lead, the product designer are the ones that I believe need to constantly live in those two phases of preparing something for the next delivery, but at the same time supporting the delivery. But the better job they're doing on the discovery, the less they require involvement during the delivery and can actually focus again on the next interval. And any team that cannot look into the future and put some thought into this will ultimately just be reactive, and that's not particularly what I like.
Okay. And besides that, how do you arrange your teams? How do you organize your teams?
So this is something that I took from ThoughtWorks and the way that we're working with a client. I believe that the problem needs to be as close as possible, so the team needs to be as close as possible to the problem. So how do we set this up? While we have reporting lines, those reporting lines don't reflect the communication path and should never. They're rather a path of whom to ask for budget, whom to ask for a promotion. Who to ask for salary raise. This is what reporting lines are ultimately there for. Who do I escalate to if I feel there's a risk that I'd like to voice? So the way that we set up teams is that they get combined with a product owner from another department, such as in operations, in growth, etc. And this product owner is there to tell, hey, this is a solution I would buy. And the team is proposing solutions. And this is usually the interactions that those both teams have. The teams de facto need to be cross-functional. So I don't believe in front-end teams, in back-end teams, etc. The team needs to be fully equipped with all the skills required to run the show. I'm always favoring effectiveness over efficiency. So I couldn't be bothered with everyone being busy. It's about, do they constantly deliver? And if that means that sometimes front desk has less to do, I'm pretty sure they're all adults enough to figure out what they can improve on their stack, that once more front-end topics come into play, that they can deliver quicker. Everyone complains about tech debt. That is the part where you work on the tech debt, right? If your skill is not that heavily required, or maybe support in backend, or from backend support in frontend, this is how people can grow ultimately.
Okay, and how many teams do you have?
So it's right now 16 teams, of which we differentiate between platform and product teams. The platform teams are there to provide a capability. So they are abstracting the ability to unlock a vehicle. For the product teams, the capability of unlocking a vehicle needs to be, from a software perspective, non-distinguishable from unlocking a bike, e-moped, or a scooter. All the complexity lies in the responsibility of the platform team. The product teams are there to monetize the platform teams. The product teams are there to monetize the capabilities provided by the platform teams. And then there's obviously another layer of platform teams in the regards of the entire infrastructure, and ultimately the IoT platform that I've mentioned, where people can deploy the software in.
That's already a team in your company.
It is already a team, yes. And the so-called push pods, so the charging stations for four batteries that can be swapped by customers standing in one of the retail shops, are already equipped with our own IoT. And people can actually push business logic on top of this, so that this piece of hardware is acting on the edge on events it's getting. An example again there is when and this is then high level implementation, so written with Node.js or in this case Python. If the batteries are reporting that the temperature is going up, it's not a firmware implementation that reacts on this, but it's actually a Python implementation using the interfaces it got, and says, okay, I got the event that the temperature is up. I'm going to increase now the speed of the ventilations.
Okay, so it sounds as if at a certain time I could potentially build an own app for the Tier platform, right?
So. It is a little bit, but it will be internal. This is definitely, but you're right. This is the kind of ecosystem. You're building a platform, but the platform is very much internal to allow others to deploy applications on top of it at ease.
Into your scooter. And yes. We started at the team discussion. So do you also have virtual teams for such topics where it's more about like potentially finding out if things are feasible?
I think that is the crucial part. Not necessarily whether something is feasible. This is part of discovery for me, that the team is getting confidence on, I can actually deliver this in a reasonable amount of time. The other part is then if we're not sure if something's going to work out for the company, then we rather say, okay, we're going to make a project out of this. It has a defined time where it ends, and either afterwards a product pops out that needs to be maintained and the team has been staffed around it or been handed over to another team. And in this cases, we do project teams. Those are really rather virtual, sometimes require only 2-3 people that just put their heads together for 2-3 days. And yeah.
Okay. Sounds very feasible.
Indeed.
So coming back to you, is there anything in your life, like a role model, coach, or a mentor you fully trust? Like you mentioned Martin Fowler before, and your reason why you went to ThoughtWorks. Yeah. Is there anyone that is left from that area?
So yeah, like happy to go through this. Like Martin Fowler, definitely, he's like this. He's for me this icon of thought leadership. He represents everything that I love about ThoughtWorks, from the technical understanding, from still having the ability to be hands-on, being influential everywhere, but so much caring about society, and understanding the responsibility and impact that he has with software, and taking a stand there also specifically on Twitter. then it's Pat Kuhr, former ThoughtWorks alumni, has been the CTO of N26. His ability and his clear definition of what a tech lead is has inspired me a lot on how I structure my teams. And then there's Eric Bowman, who I'm in constant contact with, who is, he's like a library. He has faster access to knowledge than Google in certain things. You just drop a certain topic, and he, I don't know if that's the right word in English, but like barfs out a ton of references. And then you need to digest this first. And you have a lunch with him, and he throws you in a positive way under a bus with a bunch of information, and so insightful. This is just amazing. So definitely something.
Yeah, I know him from Zalando. He's a myth, that guy.
Yeah.
So, okay. And then, do you have, like, being a nerd still, I assume, do you have a favorite tool you are bugging everyone with right now, you're pushing everyone to use, or?
Yeah. Pact has been one I have been particularly bullish with, because Pact is not necessarily an amazing tool, but it's the best out there to ensure contract testing amongst various services. And if you want to go into, call it whatever you like, microservices, service-oriented architecture, but ultimately multiple services talking over events or APIs with each other, there needs to be contract testing in place. Otherwise, you can't keep up with the pace. So Pact has been one particular thing. When it's for behaviors, it's pairing. I'm less successful there, but I'm constantly asking people, like, why don't you just pair on this? And you will be fine, right? Instead of trying to optimize for everyone is doing or starting them particularly, more things at the same time. And when it comes to metrics, it's the four key metrics derived from the book Accelerate. And this is how we measure the team performance of each and every team independently of stack. It just doesn't matter. We just look at what is your lead time, what is your time to recovery, what is your build failure rate, and what is your deployment frequency. And that gives me all the knowledge I need.
Okay. Very nice. Very, very hands-on on tips. Thanks a lot for that. Okay, Matthias, I have a little surprise for you. I stole one of your scooters and installed an alternative firmware with a hidden time machine feature. We can now jump on it and travel back into 2009, the year you started at Lieferando. We observe what is happening for a while, and now you have the chance to silently whisper something into young Matthias' ear. What would it be?
So first of all, don't do this backflip. It might have ended otherwise differently. I think the second part would be, and it's kind of a repetition from what I said in the beginning, in the middle, and now at the end, it's listen to people, like value people over the tech. I've made one huge mistake in the merge between the two teams when I've been assigned CTO of the entity takeaway. So I thought I can fix everything with technology. I'm just figuring out how we're going to put all those things together. And I thought of event buses and all the fancy technologies. And I thought I'm going to make people excited and they're just going to follow my lead. But what people actually were interested in was, what will be my role if I see at least a single person on the other side that is working on the exact same thing? So will I be redundant? And not understanding that specifically a merger of two companies is only about the people has created so much frustration and so much time investment. And led then ultimately to a lot of people leaving because they just couldn't bear with the politics anymore. And I was always wondering, like, where are the politics? But like, yeah, they were just here in front of me. And how to address this, I should have just taken a stand on, we're just deciding for one stack. And it actually doesn't matter which one. Instead, I followed the recommendation to say, no, we need to combine the best of both, and that's going to be your mission. So I said, okay, I'm going to figure it out. And I should have just taken a sense like, no, this is not what we're going to do. We're just flipping a coin now, and we're taking this stack, and we're focusing on migrating everything over. And then, whoosh, we have 50% of capacities available for all the new stuff that we can focus on instead of fighting ourselves through 2 years of migration, which ultimately resulted in the same, that one stack has been decided for, and I couldn't bother less. I'm maybe at the starting point, not, but by now I'm not that egocentric to say it must have been my stack. I was proud of this one, but I could have just flipped the coin.
Okay, so flip the coin early. Or don't flip the coin, right?
Exactly.
And focus on people. Thanks a lot, Matthias.
You're welcome.
Enjoy your evening and hope to see you soon.
Same to you. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks again to our sponsors, Fastly and MongoDB. To learn more about the Fastly services and get first-class support, just visit fastly.com/alphalist. And to try the new cloud product of MongoDB called MongoDB Atlas, just go to cloud.mongodb.com and use the promo code podcast2020 to get started for free.